This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. In the modern financial world, of course, Wall Street is king, but that ascent did not happen without exploitation. In particular, African slaves provided capital for some of the nation's most powerful financial institutions. Nautilus Mutual Life Insurance, what is now New York Life Insurance, offered policies on slaves, allowing slave owners to claim funds on their lost property when slaves died. But the financial gain wasn't only the slave owner. Nautilus and others used premiums on slave policies to build their wealth and grow their companies. New York Times correspondent Rachel Swarens researched the sale of these policies, including some in eastern North Carolina, and she joins me now on the State of Things. Rachel, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about these policies, Nautilus Life Insurance Company in New York, and the decision to sell policies on slaves. What were these policies like?
So Nautilus, the predecessor company to New York Life, opened up in 1845, and there were a number of bigger, more established competitors. And in its first year, you know, sales were slow, and it decided to look south. And basically, it wanted to distinguish itself, and one way to do that was by offering insurance policies to slave owners, which was not very common at the time among the northern insurance companies. And this was, you know, a boon for the men and women who owned slaves in the South, because for the first time, they could recoup some money up to three-quarters of a slave's value, you know, upon the demise of their human property. You know, slaves were, of course, human beings, but they were property in the eyes of their owners and in the law. And so if a slave died, you know, basically a slave owner lost everything. This changed that calculus, and it allowed for slave owners to, you know, have their slaves work in very risky businesses as the South was beginning to industrialize.
Yeah, and you found out that most of these policies were not necessarily field workers, but people who were employed in more risky businesses, right?
That's right. I mean, there were New York Life sold about 500 of these policies, and the vast majority were sold on slaves who were involved in risky work, in coal mines, on steamboats, in, you know, sawmills, places where their owners might rightly be worried about losing their investment.
And it was an investment, so these were life insurance policies, but not in the way that a white life would have been insured or indemnified. In fact, they were insured as property, right?
Well, you know, it was life insurance, but of course the difference was for whites who bought life insurance at the time, you know, for themselves or for members of their families, if the person died, the benefit went back to the grieving relatives. This benefit all went to the owner of the slave, and, you know, neither the slave nor the grieving relatives, African-American relatives of the slave, saw any benefit of that.
Now, how did you go about finding the archives? It turns out that New York Life, which is the company that Nautilus became, does still have the records of these sales, right?
In the early 2000s, this became an issue. Activists, African-American activists, and around the country, and municipalities, localities around the country, began requiring large companies to disclose their connections, their financial connections to slavery. And this came out during that time. And so basically New York Life, and it's not just New York Life, Aetna, U.S. Life, were required by law to disclose their records. And when they were required to do so, New York Life kind of looked around and said, okay, well, what do we have? And it turned out that they had in a kind of informal storage room, you know, tons and tons of records documenting these policies.
When you went through, was it possible to find then the descendants of those who had been insured? And as you say, the money didn't go to their families, it went to the white owners. But to what extent were you able to make those connections?
Well, you know, the New York Life has a private corporate archive where it has some records. The company also donated some records to the Schomburg, which is part of the New York Public Library, allowing access to some of these records to the public. And so these records are these old, really large, weighty volumes. They're ledgers, really. They're business records where they include the names of the person who bought the policy as well as the name of the person insured and a little bit of information about the person who was insured. And I was very interested in trying to see whether it was possible to trace the descendants, because what interests me about this history is that, of course, we're talking about the 1840s, New York Life sold these policies between 1845 and 1848. But, you know, this is not just old history. This was a part of the company's business model. It was a part of how New York Life became what it is today. And I have a lot of interest in trying to help our readers and Americans understand that there are these connections between past and present. So I went into this with an interest in trying to identify descendants. It's not easy, but I was able to do so.
And I guess on that on the point of sort of how these companies capitalized themselves, it's interesting to hear what happened over those 3 years, because eventually New York Life dropped the whole program. It turned out not to be profitable in the end, but it was critical to them in the very beginning stages as they capitalized themselves and grew their wealth, right?
That's exactly right. So this was not a booming, lucrative business for New York Life in the end, because the death rates were so high, and it's really kind of horrible if you think about it, because it meant that basically, you know, these African-American enslaved workers were in really perilous positions. But the premiums only barely exceeded the death claims. And so in 1848, New York Life decided not to sell the policies anymore. But historians say that the policies really were important to the company's development. They basically helped the company, raise capital in the early years to get it going. And it also helped it establish a network of agents and relationships in the South, which was fairly unique among companies. And New York Life continued to capitalize on those relationships, selling life insurance to white customers even after the slave policies were ended.
Well, and insurance policies and insurance premiums are the lifeblood of other capital networks as well, because that money gets invested in other ways, and so that becomes part of that big, wide global investment world that we never see, but is in many ways owes itself to the unpaid labor.
That's absolutely right. So there were doctors, local doctors, you know, who had to examine the slaves who were paid. There were newspapers, advertisements were taking out. All of this money created was part of an economy that in the South and and the Northern companies benefited from this.
And an economy in which enslaved people and their families weren't able to participate. So that money wasn't inherited by the next generation, which would allow them to build wealth, buy property, and be part of the American
dream. That's right. And it's important to note also, of course, that it wasn't just New York Life. Among insurance companies, Aetna and U.S. Life also sold insurance policies to slave owners, and other financial institutions, benefited from the slave economy too. The banks, J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo, absorbed banks that allowed Southerners who were looking for loans to use their slaves as collateral. It was part of the economy in a way. It's not a surprise when you think about it. But, you know, we don't often think about big northern financial institutions as being part of this economy, but it was a big part of the national economy.
Right, and some of this came to light over 10 years ago, as you point out and point out again in your article, when Georgetown University and the research that you did and an article you did about Georgetown and selling the fact that it made money by selling slaves, and J.P. Right. Morgan, these other financial institutions. Many of them made public apologies in 2005 and made some restitution, but it is hard to calculate the amount of wealth lost to families and the amount of wealth generated by these businesses in these early stages of their development.
That's absolutely right. And I think it's just important, you know, as Americans, for us to just to keep in mind, it seems so long ago, and, you know, it's the textbooks and history, old history, but really it was such an integral part of the economy and an integral part of many of the institutions that remain with us today.
I want to take a break right here and come back and talk with you just a little bit more, Rachel, because I know you found some of those families and some of those insured individuals right here in North Carolina. We'll talk a little bit more about that when I return. I'm talking with Rachel Swarns. She is a correspondent with the New York Times, and you are listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today to New York Times correspondent Rachel Swarns, who wrote a piece called Insurance Policies on Slaves, New York Life's Complicated Past. And Rachel, you pointed out this. We've talked about the fact that this is not to demonize New York Life. Certainly, they're not alone. Other insurance companies, other financial institutions, Wells Fargo, Wachovia, et cetera, Georgetown University, all part of the system. But the point of this is to understand that this is still with us today. Wealth was built, and much of what we're looking at today owes itself to some of this. But I do wonder what happened. New York Life representatives, you said you want to prowl their archives for more research. What was their response?
They were, it was kind of a mix of things. On the one hand, they were quite open and helpful in many respects. They provided me with additional information beyond what is publicly available in there in the Schomburg in the New York Public Library. You know, we had extensive discussions over the several months that I was working on this. On the other hand, and I should mention, they provided me with some ledgers that were from their corporate archive, which were not available to the public, and that was very helpful. On the other hand, they did decline when I asked to speak to the archivist for their you know, private archive to find out whether there were any additional materials that might be relevant, and they would not do that. I cannot say why, but I this is a difficult subject that they were they have been open about over the years, but were also very uncomfortable with because, as you might imagine, and most companies would rather not have this, you know, a story like this in the front page of the New York
right.
Times. So I think that there's more, and I think that, you know, they were comfortable with my seeing only so much.
What is their take on the story itself and kind of where it is today? How do they play this?
I think, you know, this was a company that was born in the 1840s in New York City when, you know, the money from the plantations was a big driver of the New York City economy. Today, of course, New York Life is a diverse a company, diverse in terms of its employees and in terms of its customer base. And so this is, you know, it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable history. And they have made efforts to make amends, you know, making the donation of the records to the Schomburg, of some of the records to the Schomburg so that they are available for folks trying to find their history, making donations, significant ones, millions of dollars to African-American charities and causes. So they have tried to be open to a certain extent and to, you know, to help in, you know, with their dollars in terms of philanthropy.
What about the value of this and in terms of identifying descendants? I know you've have done some work in this, and in fact there are links to even Wilmington and ads here in Wilmington, North Carolina. Maybe we should talk more about that. How much do you know about what was going on in eastern North Carolina? That's the first question.
Yeah, so the company in the 1840s advertised in local newspapers in the South you know, letting people know about this business. If you, you know, have slaves who are occupied in dangerous positions, we will offer insurance. And I ended up focusing on Virginia for the local angle of my story, but I came across advertisements from, you know, newspapers across North Carolina, in New Bern, North Carolina, in Wilmington, North Carolina, where their agents were spreading the word and letting slave owners know that this was a way to preserve a significant portion of your investment.
Is there value in trying to identify the descendants of these, the people who are named in these policies, and what do you think that would yield?
I think there's enormous value in that. One of the things that's interesting is that, you know, of course, this is difficult, painful history, and these records are a testament to that. On the other hand, though, these records are a treasure trove. It's a huge. It's amazing, really, that they still exist, and that for African Americans who it's very, very difficult to trace ancestors back into slavery. The census only began recording African Americans who were enslaved by their full names in the 1870. So, and newspapers didn't chronicle, you know, births and marriages and things like that of enslaved people. And of course, many were states barred slaves from learning to read or write, so there are no letters. So this is a real opportunity. Now, it's very difficult because sometimes they only mention the first name of a slave, but often there are full names. And so with the help of a genealogist at Ancestry.com, we were able to identify a family tracing the descendants of a slave by the name of Nathan York, who was a coal miner in Virginia, Midlothian, Virginia.
And the result was really astonishing in some ways when the descendants found out, and you profile at least one woman who, when she found out, really was upended by the news.
She really was. It was amazing because she was, she's a scientist, a retired scientist, who happens to be the historian for her church. She knew the church was founded by coal miners, and she had done a lot of research on other members of the church, but had never done her own family history. And so when I called, I told her that, you know, one of the founders of the church was an ancestor of hers, and that he had been insured, his life had been insured by New York Life.
So when we're telling these stories, and again, the significance is not just talking about a troubled past in the United States, but how it affects us all today. I'm sure in the process of doing this, you've uncovered other industries. You talked about how much the economy of New York depended on the Southern agrarian economy, the clothing industry, shipping industry, banking, you know, insurance and the rest. Are you going to do more of these? Because there are certainly other industries that can be explored.
One of the interesting things that has come out of this process, which began really when I began looking at Georgetown University's roots in slavery, is that historians have gotten in touch saying, oh, well, don't forget about the railroads, for instance, or don't forget about this industry. And truly, this is a very rich line of research. And these connections between past and present are made easier, though not, you know, not terribly easy, but tracing families, you know, many of these records are now digitized. Doing the searches are much easier than they used to be. Unfortunately, and fortunately for me, I'm going on leave to write a book about Georgetown University's roots in slavery, so I won't be continuing, at least for a while.
We will welcome that book and then your return to this beat, and maybe you'll have attracted others as well. Rachel, thanks so much for your work.
Thank you.
Rachel Swarns is a correspondent with the New York Times. You can find a link to her piece and some of the ads that we've talked about at our website, stateofthings.org. The piece is called Insurance Policies on Slaves, New York Life's Complicated Past. We've got links to all of that at our website, stateofthings.org.